Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com worldwide. I am indeed honored and delighted to welcome Cormac O'Malley, who was raised in Newport, County Mayo, and he is the son of Ernie O'Malley, Irish nationalist, and author of the autobiography memoirs On Another Man's Wound, The Singing Flame, and Raids and Rallies. And a little bit, first of all, let me welcome you, Cormac O'Malley. We've known each other for a long time. Around the same time, since we're about the same age, you were growing up in Newport, in County Mayo. Tell us a little bit about that part of your life, you know, the early years.
Well, my mother, my American mother, Helen Hooker, had married my father in 1935, and they lived in Dublin for a couple of years, and then after father got sued and lost the libel case for his book On Another Man's Wound, he sort of went back to his roots in Mayo. And they were doing photography and folklore and other things. And along came the Second World War with its peculiar variation in Ireland. One of the things that De Valera said to the Irish citizens was, go out and become farmers and be self-sustaining. And my father took that very seriously with their newly acquired property in Newport, Mayo. And they developed almost a self-sustaining farm for the war years, called the Emergency. And so I was raised in the middle of a farm in Newport with people, you know, seeding and recovering the potatoes, the wheat, we had cattle and horses and sheep and pigs, all of the animals in the zoo. It's a rural land. And they even put up one of those electricity things that we could get electricity in the house, a wind charger.
Oh, the
and
wind
so we
train,
lived
yeah.
there relatively comfortably until 1944 when we continued to live for all holidays and weekends in Mayo, but we had some schooling to attend to in Dublin. But all our holidays were down there. We had the boat there. We had the farmers. We had our pet animals. It was not luxurious. I mean, you know, the wind charger died after about 5 months, and so we were still carrying candles around. And when my mother left my father in 1948, my father was taking care of my brother, my sister, and myself. I was the youngest. And we lived in that one, that house. And eventually, she came back and kidnapped my brother and sister in 1950. And so my father and I lived in that one house. And under circumstances, the farm was somewhat gone by then, and father was very busy doing his interviewing his comrades, 450 comrades around the country, and we still lived a very rural life. You know, it was a mile and a half, 2 miles into Newport if you wanted to walk, and we went into mass on Sundays. So, you know, it's good rural life. A Latin lamp, use of the boat to fish, things like that.
Now, you went on from there to Black Rock College, and so when did you come to the United States? Well, let's just, where did you go after Black Rock Secondary School?
Well, what I did is I went up to, when my mother disappeared and my siblings disappeared, my father was very concerned with my security in case she kidnapped me. And so I was put in boarding schools behind high walls whenever I could. And in the summers and vacations, I was fostered out to stay with some of his comrades who had children.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no way my mother could kidnap me. So I lived a fairly secure life, but I had 7 years of Sackville Convent, Willow Park, Black Rock, and Antwerp College in Yorkshire.
Uh-huh.
Before my father died in 1957, and that's when he was given a state funeral by De Valera.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother came back for the funeral, and she brought me to America in 1957.
Now, your mother was, she was from Connecticut, right?
She was a Connecticut Yankee.
Yeah. Okay.
Who was an artist.
Mm-hmm.
They met on the art scene, fell in love in New York, and father wanted to go back to get his pension in 1935. So she ran away from her family, who totally disagreed with her choice of man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the Yankee perspective at that time, my father was a Catholic, unemployed, had not finished university, was a socialist, was involved in an Irish Revolution, and the fight that they had over the family table in Connecticut was about how poorly the Americans had supported the American Indians. So there were five or six against Ernie O'Malley.
Yeah.
And he was told never to return to the household.
Oh, boy. Now, Ernie O'Malley, God knows there have been so many books and essays and stories written about your father, referred to as the Bohemian Revolutionary who traveled the world, and so many other titles of it. Your recollections of your father, Ernie, and how he became, as far as you're concerned, how he became, first of all, involved, and then rose to be, you know, to the highest level during that Irish Revolutionary period.
Well, he was our family name is Malley, M-A-L-L-E-Y,
mm-hmm.
not O'Malley. But when Ernest Bernard Malley came to sign up for the IRA, the Irish Volunteers in 1916, after Easter Rising, there was no way that they were going to register him with those names. So he became Ernan O'Malley.
Mm-hmm.
Would sign throughout his revolutionary days Ernon, or E-A for
right.
Ernon. Anyway, he later adopted the name Ernie O'Malley.
Yeah.
So in 1916, that Malley family and my uncles had gone off to fight with the British in the Dublin Fusiliers and were off on the continent. My grandfather worked for the British in the Irish Land Commission and the District Board. And so you can imagine that the table conversation was relatively conservative, and they were making laughter at the men dressed in green, the Irish Volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a surprise to Father himself when he went down on Easter Monday, which is the day of the rising, April 24, 1916, and he went down to Sackville Street, O'Connell Street, and saw the mess around Nelson's Pillar, and he read the Proclamation of Independence. And
mm-hmm.
he was really very impressed by that, and he was reading words like Ireland should be for the Irish and ourselves alone and things like words
mm-hmm.
like that. And so that evening, he went out and took up a Mauser with a friend of his and started shooting against the British troops down on the Liffey. And he then secretly joined the Irish Volunteers a couple of months later. And while he was still at university, was involved in the Irish Volunteers activities, which were marching up in the Wicklow Hills, raising funds, attending church and learning Irish and learning how to dance. All of these things he did not know because of his, let's say, English-oriented establishment attitude.
Mm.
And so it was all new. They were having great fun learning about themselves and their country. And he went on the run in 1918. He just got fed up. And he went to work for the Irish Volunteer headquarters, which was pretty small at the time. And when he walked in, he met Michael Collins. And he worked for Collins and Mulcahy from 1918 through 1921. And they sent him around as an organizer. And an organizer had that dirty business of trying to go down to the country people and make them into soldiers by parading them with hurley sticks and trying to get discipline into them, give them lectures about how to fight the British. This was not something which the rural countrymen really wanted to do. And, you know, there was a story which Father tells that the family would prefer to see an RIC person come in and question their son than Ernie O'Malley, because if Ernie O'Malley came in and if the young man got bitten by nationalism, he'd be lost to the family anyway.
Right.
He'd be off in the hills. And so he was not highly regarded by the families whom he visited in. He worked in about 18 different brigades over those 3 years, from Tipperary to Donegal, from Roscommon to Wexford and Dublin.
Yes.
Anyway, and Collins sent him over to London for one or two things. He was a good friend with Collins, had a high regard for him.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, you know, he was captured in 1920 by the Brits, brought into Dublin Castle, tortured. Kicked out to Kilmainham Jail. One of the three people ever to escape from Kilmainham Jail in February 14, 1921. That's quite a story. And then Collins gave him command of the 2nd Southern Division, which involved Kilkenny, Derry, and Limerick.
Yeah.
And he was promoted to be a Commandant General at age 23. Which is a pretty senior position,
yes,
if you look
indeed.
At any army in the world.
Now, when he, Michael Collins, who sent him to London to buy arms, was it known by then, and was he a marked man, as it were, by the time it came to 1918? Would the authorities or intelligence have known about his involvement throughout the country?
No, he was, in fact, if you pass forward to December 31, 1920,
mm-hmm.
Father had already been captured. They didn't know who he was. He gave a false name. They'd never heard of Bernard Stewart. What happened on 31, there was a raid in Dawson Street in the private apartment of Eileen McCarville. She was then not married. That was her married name. Anyway, Eileen McGrain. When they found papers at Michael Collins, of course, they were very happy. And then they found the name of a new leader called O'Malley.
Yeah.
No idea who O'Malley was. After a month, by late January 1921, they had discovered that O'Malley was, in fact, Ernie O'Malley, or Ernie Malley.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a brother of two people. And we have the letter that the intelligence in Dublin Castle wrote to my uncle, at least to my uncle's commander in East Africa, asking him, did he know where his brother was, notorious rebel. When when Father heard that they knew his name, he and Colin said, "You better get him out from Kilmainham because otherwise he'd be shot." So that's why the urgency of getting Ernie O'Malley out of Kilmainham jail, and he got out in mid-February.
This is the 107th anniversary of the Easter Rising, and which, if we look at it, was mostly in Dublin, whereas there were, you know, skirmishes in counties in Meath, Galway, Louth, Wexford, Cork. Was your father, Ernie O'Malley, was he openly or secretly trying, or was he in charge of recruiting, some for the cause, going throughout the country, or was that somebody else? Was that a group of people? Was he involved in that?
Well, Father was not involved, actually, in the 1916 event.
Right.
He really only came to it on that Monday when he read the proclamation. So
yeah.
His participation was really only subsequent to that. And, of course, one of the reasons that the rising occurred only in Dublin was because of the counter command by MacNeill, and then the counter-command by the IRA. But by the time the second command got through, there were so few people around the country that they weren't able to have a real rising.
Yeah. But on the on this anniversary and the significance of Easter week, I'm sure that a lot of people... those who have not studied know much about the Easter Rising and how that brought around, you know, still not perfect, according to Ernie O'Malley. He was for a united Ireland. So were those who participated in the Easter Rising. It had to be known at that point that the British Army had, tremendous resources, manpower, and of course they, the might of the British Army. So how would you describe the Easter Rising itself, and how you could give us a synopsis of how that actually changed the course of history for Irish, for Ireland?
Well, I mean, one of the things that history teaches us is to examine facts. And you might ask the question, was 16 well received in 1916? And the answer is no. When we look at it romantically after, 107 years, do we credit Ireland as having well received the 1916 revolution? And the answer is yes. We go back and mistake history. But when Dublin was destroyed by the British, there was no empathy for those people who had caused that destruction. Very little empathy. The reason the empathy came about was the blunders in their executing, in the execution of the 16 martyrs at the end of that month. Had they not executed, and had they not rounded up, I mean, there were two things which went on. One is the execution, and the other thing is they rounded up as many rebels as they could, not only in Dublin, but around the countryside, and they sent them over to Llandaff in Wales. Now, there were two silly decisions by an empire. First of all, you start execution, which creates empathy. And secondly, you put all those who are guilty of participation in location. and they had never met before. So the irony is that Frangok, the British, became a university and an establishment whereby Republicans could really organize. And as a result of that, for the next year when they were in turn, they were sort of marched up and down. They had discipline. Those who hadn't learned Irish learned Irish. And by 1917, there was a whole fresh unit of Irish revolutionaries coming out of the British jail. And that was what turned the tide. Now, it was also, remember, this is also before the Sinn Féin election of November 1918. And as people came home, they started to become aware as to the home rule issue and the question as to whether the Sinn Féin principle of it, having ourselves alone and having their own independent parliament. And so it was after the election of 1918, things started to swing in favor of the Republicans, not only in Dublin, but down the country. But those critical factors, which again have been romanticized greatly, came very slowly to the Irish people. And it was only by early 1919, when the Irish Parliament met in January of that year, that there was started to be a real support for the Irish Volunteers. And so people like my father had less difficulty going down the country to energize people because they saw that they had a parliament, that they had a president, that they were willing to make sacrifices, that they were going to have an independent country ultimately. Remember, in 1919, the Government of Ireland Act had not been passed. The Government of Ireland Act is the one which divided the six counties from the 26. So what they were fighting for was a 32-county republic, because that's what it was at the time.
You know, I would it would be great, and we will invite you back. I know that, again, you have lectured. You have spent most of your recent years, and I might, you know, let our listeners know that you made your bread and butter through the years in international private law practice in New York and Mexico, followed by 20 years as international corporate counsel while living in Brussels, London, and New York. But you've been here since 1999, and among the many organizations that you have indeed run and been part of, you are president of the Board of Advisors at Glucksman Ireland House, the Centre for the Board of Advisors at Glucksman Ireland House, the Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies in New York. You know, we want to thank you for filling us in. We didn't get as much as we would normally have time for on Ernie O'Malley, but there is so much written, and he played such a tremendous part in the revolution, and giving his all, his counsel, and his ability to win over a great number of of people to the side of the Republicans, and to sometimes that smacks of being a bad word might be today, but it definitely wasn't if we go back to the teens and the 20s and beyond in Ireland. Thank you, Cormac, and again, we'd be delighted to have you back in the future, and have a happy Easter.
Well, thank you, and let's remember those who died on Easter Monday.
Yep.
And who died for the cause ever since. So thank you, Adrian. Look forward to the next time.
Okay. Thank you again very much. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USAIrishRadio.com.